It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're in for Veronica Rickert and Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, our guest encourages us to address aging more directly by appreciating both its pleasures and its perils.
Now, though, we continue to remember the life of Nelson Mandela. In the days since his passing last Thursday, leaders, thinkers, and the public have had the chance to reflect on Mandela's life and on his legacy. This weekend, four presidents and 60 other world leaders will be attending Nelson Mandela's funeral.
As the world pays tribute to Nelson Mandela, Milwaukee's James Causey says Mandela's work is far from over.
James Causey is a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he wrote an op-ed in this weekend's paper titled, To Honor Mandela, Continue the Struggle. James, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I want to start out with kind of the beginning of your piece that was published over the weekend. You know, you're a professional writer, you're a blogger, and yet you found yourself at a loss for words.
Yeah, I mean, when you lose a leader such as Nelson Mandela, everyone is going to want to say something. And, you know, what you try to do as a columnist, you want to come up with something different to say. But with so many people speaking out on this, I just felt like I was a loss for words of what to really say. So I just wanted to list some of his accomplishments and talk about what he would want us to do moving forward.
And I want to talk about some of those accomplishments because, you know, taken individually, if you take any sort of one thing on his list, for most of us, that would be the defining aspect of our entire lives. And yet he has a list, at least by your column, almost a page long. I mean, how do you sum up a life like that?
That was the hard part because on accomplishments alone, very few people can match what Mandela accomplished. But we need to look beyond that. And he was a very humble man. And that's one of the things that I took from looking at some of the videos of him. He was very humble. He didn't want the limelight. But what he wanted was for us to fight for justice and equality. And it didn't matter if it was in Africa, if it was in the United States, Canada, Germany, or wherever injustice was, he wanted us to fight for everyone to have the same rights. And because of that, I said, this is what we need to do right here and now. Yes, we should mourn Mr. Mandela, and we should remember all the great things he accomplished. But if we stop there, then we're not completing his mission. We need to reach across the aisles, reach across those barriers that we've built up against one another, and grab each other by the hand and try to walk this last few miles together, because that's the only way that we're going to get any place. I think we argue too much on differences. We want to fight and bicker over things that really, in the big scheme of things, don't really mean a lot. Because we're all pretty much the same and we all pretty much want the same things. It's just how we get there is the hard part. So we have to walk these last few miles together in order to make make his dream become a reality.
And I wondered about that because, you know, as we've been watching the news accounts in the last couple of days, as we've been reading all the various tributes, you know, one of the things is you look at Nelson Mandela and a lot of people think, well, you know, that happened in South Africa. And I'm wondering whether that message has made its way here to Milwaukee, to Wisconsin, whether people make that connection that, you know, he was talking about things over there, but it matters here, too.
Oh, of course. And that's what when I came into work, my boss, David Haynes, said, James, I want you to, you know, think about what we could do, what you could say to, you know, bring it close to home. And it was really easy because there is injustice everywhere. And if we just think that this just exists in South Africa, then we're missing the big picture here. You know, you turn on the local news every day and you see people who have been discriminated against, people who don't think things or believe things have gone their way. And we often see how we can help change things, how we could change the outcome by just stepping up and being a part of the solution. I think right now, and this is one thing I try to do in my columns, I try to come up with solutions. And part of the problem is too many of us, we stand on the sideline and criticize because that's the easiest thing to do. We want to criticize people on the opposite side of the aisle because it's easier to do that. The hard part is rolling up your sleeves and actively getting involved. It's easy to criticize somebody that's doing wrong. We do that every day. But to help that person and to help them change their ways and see the right way to do it, now that's the hard part, and we need to do more of that.
And the other thing that I think that is difficult, because as you say, a lot of people do stand on the sidelines and, you know, sort of lob stones. But when you talk about the idea of reaching beyond personal barriers and grabbing one another by the hand, there's also that idea of people actually taking action and taking a step. Did Nelson Mandela make it easier or more possible for people to take those steps?
Well, one thing that I took from Mandela is that he believed nothing is more empowering than forgiveness. And I think if you could forgive someone for doing you wrong and talking about it and moving forward, then that makes you a bigger person. Now, I'm not saying you should let anyone take advantage of you, but I'm saying find it in yourself to look for that forgiveness, especially if that person deserves your forgiveness in the first place. I think what we do right now, we harbor too many emotions. We just figure that group is against us. This, if you're not with us, you're against us. And we can't agree to disagree. You could agree to disagree and still move forward. I think what we do is as soon as we disagree, we stop and nothing happens. And so we deal with the same problems that we were dealing with 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and maybe even 25 years ago. And for our children, we need to do more than that. For ourselves, we need to do more than that. For our ancestors, we need to do more than that. And I think that's what the essence of Mandela was all about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Mandela sort of exemplified is he never stopped. You know, no matter what the opposition was, you know, he was in prison for 27 years. He never stopped.
Right, right. And, you know, very, like I said, you know, President Obama said it best, we may not ever see another Nelson Mandela in our lifetimes, but I think we all could be like that in our own way, shape, and form. We don't need to stop ourselves. I mean, we all have the ability to move forward. We all have the ability to be leaders. We just have to look deep inside ourselves and pull that out.
You know, how do you personalize that, though? Because, as you say, everybody has that potential, but, boy, not everybody has that confidence.
That confidence is really hard, and I think what we need to do in order to pull it out is look and see what made Mandela special. I mean, when you think about all his accomplishments, before he did that, he was just a regular kid who was playing games in South Africa, not knowing that he was going to be thrust into this movement. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was a preacher's son. He didn't know he was going to be thrust into that movement. What made them get to that point? We need to study them more and never forget about them. That's why I said we should have a national holiday for Nelson Mandela. So during those times, we could go back and study and see what made these people great, so we could look in ourselves and see how we could be great as well.
Now, we've got four former presidents attending Nelson Mandela's funeral, as well as a myriad of other world leaders. A lot of that, of course, is very symbolic, but what a symbol. What do you make of that?
I think it's fantastic. But what we do after that, again, will mean more. The world can't do enough. I know a lot of people are going to be crying. But I don't think this is a time to cry. I think this is a time for celebration. One thing I said in my column is that Mandela was holding on for a long time. He was teetering in and out of the hospital, and then there was times where we thought this was it, that he was going to pass away, and he hung on longer. And, you know, it was time for him to rest. His body had given out. But during that time, I think we had an opportunity here to learn a lot about ourselves. You know, yes, he was a great man, and yes, he taught us a lot. But we have to take those tools, those things that he taught us, the forgiveness, the never giving up, that your second act could be better than your first, and that good leaders can rise in good times. We need to take those things and internalize them and become these great people that we all have in ourselves. I mean, we often tell our kids at school, you could grow up to be president one day. Well, what happens in between the time that they're 5 and 6 years old and the time that they're 18 that they say, no, that's not a possibility for me? What happens to the millions of kids who drop out of school every year? I mean, we have to do something to reach these kids so they can reach their fullest potential. And somewhere along the lines, we missed that.
Well, James Causey, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, thank you.
Appreciate your time. James Causey has been with us. He is a columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we were discussing his recent article published over the weekend, To Honor Mandela, Continue the Struggle. This is Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Later in the hour, we'll hear the story of how Otis Redding lost his life in Madison.
First, though, we take a look at some of the challenges of aging. In our society, aging is often something that we try to deny. We try to hide it. And while, yes, we are living longer, we all have to face up to the fact that at some point we are going to get old.
Our next guest says we shouldn't ignore that fact, and she confronts it head-on in her most recent book called Out of Time, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging. She's Lynn Siegel. She is the anniversary professor of psychological and gender studies at Birkbeck College. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Cynthia.
Why do we have such a hard time coping with the fact that we're getting old?
Well, you know, there's nothing new about the fears and negative feelings towards aging. It goes back a very long time. And I think there are many reasons for it, but we're almost imbibed it from birth, really. It's there in all our folk tales and legends that there's been a certain contempt for old people as frail and useless, and in particular, there's a sort of gendering of old age as well. So if you think of the witch, the harridan, the Medusa, we sort of imbibe in our culture the idea of there being something negative about aging. And I'm afraid it's associated with the idea that we're no longer productive and useful people in our society. And this is something, since we're all going to be living longer, most of us, we've added another 30 years to our lives. It seems to me we've just got to start thinking of better stories to tell about being old.
Have you, in your research, noticed if this is an attitude that's existed over time? I'm thinking of cultures that respect the elderly in such a way that I would have assumed that they have a certain respect for old age that maybe we don't anymore.
Well, there is an idea that it is a recent phenomenon that we have not enough respect for the elderly, but actually it isn't such a new thing. If you look even back at classic periods such as ancient Greece, where certainly there were laws that children had to look after the elderly, you still find a certain contempt and laughter about the old. It's still the case that there was fear about growing old. And another thing is that you find societies which have more respect for the elderly or appear to have more respect for the elderly, there often were fewer elderly people around. And it's in our society where there's a lot more of the elderly people around that there has come to be the idea that these elderly people are going to be drawing on all our resources and they won't be able to give anything back to society, and that elderly people are going to, in some way, impoverish society. And I don't think that is in any way a useful way to be seeing things, because elderly people are actually, by and large, giving back quite as much as they're taking from society. I mean, elderly people are involved in caring for people. Grandmothers are involved in caring for people. They're involved in all sorts of ways in just the networks of support which we need. And it seems to me crucial not to see just the productive worker, the person who's producing profits for the economy, as the only significant people in society. I think we have to begin revaluing what is important about every aspect of our lives, and to realize also that life isn't just a self project. It's about what we're handing on to other people. It's about all the networks that we're engaged in, not just, for instance, productive labor.
There's often some ambiguity about when someone becomes quote-unquote old. There's not a switch that you flip or anything. But some people wake up in the morning one day and they look in the mirror and they think, geez, I look like my mother. How do we know when we're old?
Well, there's two sides to this. One, I think, is that many of us actually don't feel the age that we are, or mm-hmm. certainly most people say they don't feel old, but I think that's because they want to reject the stigma that is attached to aging, the idea that somehow they're not engaged with the world and they're not significant in some way in society. And so almost everyone, when interviewed, does claim to feel younger. You know, in research which has been done in the U.S., people in their 60s say they feel, on average, 10 years younger. And the older they get, the younger they tend to feel. And I think that that's because it's true that we are, in a sense, attached to and a part of all the things we have been. So, in a sense, we're more than one age. There's a sort of temporal vertigo, and we're both the age that we are, which at times we feel, and then at other times we feel that we're still those younger people we have been. We've got divided selves within us, and one reason why it's harder to acknowledge what it is to be old and to have lived a long life and to use those memories is that often people are not interested in what the old have to say or what their memories are. So we have to give older people the significance of having lived a long time and want to hear their stories if we're to be able to enjoy our lives as older people. And of course, we will all grow old. As you said in the beginning, we will all grow old. So whatever our age, we need to see ourselves potentially in this old woman or that old man. We need to be able to think of what it is to lead a long life and what it is to lead a good life, which is being able to, you know, respect what it is to be young, middle age, old age, to be able to be there and acknowledge something about the passing of the years, while at the same time holding on to what's important about that passage in time.
What I'm hearing you say is that there's a lot of judgment of the book by its cover. In other words, I see an older person out there and I might buy into the stereotypes that there's not a lot I can learn from them, or that they're not as, I don't know, mentally aware or I don't know, some of the things that you said. Is there more that perhaps, in the absence of people reaching out to the elderly, that the elderly could do to break some of those stereotypes?
Well, I think that we tend to all be pigeonholed in certain ways, that it's not just what we do individually. But, for instance, there has been quite a lot of attacks on my generation as the so-called baby boomers. That's happened in the U.S. and it's happened in Britain. The idea that we are in some way responsible for the need for austerity at the moment, for instance, and the reasons why there's been a certain rolling back in welfare since the 1980s as what's called neoliberalism is more in the ascendant. And it seems to me that that is precisely a sort of scapegoating and the way of placing one generation against another generation, when the reasons for any shift in and reduction in people's overall welfare hasn't anything to do with particular age groups, but everything to do with much more general economic and commercial factors that no one generation is at all responsible for, but the, you know, the organization of society as a whole.
We're talking with Lynn Siegel. She is anniversary professor of psychology and gender studies at Birkbeck College in London. She's the author of many books, including Why Feminism, and her latest book is Out of Time, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts, too. What are your experiences with or your thoughts about getting older? Is it something we ignore in our society? What are your tips for confronting age? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org.
We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with more from Lynn Siegel. This is Central Time, and we're back with Lynn Siegel, anniversary professor of psychology and gender studies at Birkbeck College in London. She's the author of many books, including Why Feminism, and her latest book is Out of Time, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging.
And we'd like to hear what you're thinking, too. We all have experience with getting older, of course, but what do you think about that? As you age, are you still thinking that you're the same 25-year-old that you used to be, or are you facing up to the reality that you're 40 or 55 or 65? Is aging something that we ignore in our society? What's your advice for confronting age? Give us a call and weigh in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. That address is talk@wpr.org.
Lynn, I wanted to ask you, out of the subtitle of your book, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging, what are the pleasures?
Well, Cynthia, I often get asked that, but the pleasures are similar to the pleasures that have always been there in life. It's the ability to love and the ability to have people to care about and to be able to engage in the world in interesting and useful ways. And there are many different ways of doing that. You don't have to be fit and strong to be able to give things to others or for others to need you. And it seems to me that the older we get, the more we have to say about the times that we have lived through, or just it becomes easier as well to deal with loss, to deal with the hard things in life, if we're lucky, and to say, well, actually, that is always a part of life. You know, life is never simply being happy. It's about being able to deal with what is thrown at you and to help others deal with that as well. And so I do think the art of handling everyday activity, the art of handling loss, in fact, is also something that can become easier with age. But that, of course, depends very much on our circumstances. There will be huge differences depending on class and finances and so on. There'll be huge differences also in terms of the respect or concern that we get from others. And my worry is that only some of us will be allowed to age with grace and to be still connected with the world. And it seems important to me that we don't have to pretend to or keep trying to be younger than we are. So I think there is a mantra that we ought to stay forever young, and that the whole notion of aging well is really that we don't really age at all. But we do age, and a full life should be able to affirm what it is to have led a long life and to be able to share that with other people who are along the same trajectory as we've already come.
What's to stop everybody from being allowed to age with grace?
Well, first of all, we will have certain greater needs as we get older. For we might have greater medical needs. We may also find ourselves separated from loved ones who have to travel around the country or are very distant from us. And also, there is this desire, both in Britain and the US in particular, but it's part of modern industrial life, that we have to be always available for the job. You know, we have to. There's been a downplaying, it seems to me, of the significance of community and of the significance of care. The whole notion of dependence is something that there's a terrible stigma about. But actually, we're all dependent on each other all our lives. And so we need to rethink, it seems to me, the ways in which we're interdependent. And that means caring for the young, caring for the old, but also seeing that whatever our age, we are dependent upon the love and support of others. And we can learn from what it is to grow old in terms of rethinking the need to actually have people who we can care about. You know, we need to be able to have people who depend on us, just like we need to be cared for when we are dependent. So that the notion of interdependence seems to me a crucial one to value if we want to think about what it is to lead a good life.
We're talking with Lynn Siegel, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's talk to Rich in Beaver Dam. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, I have a comment about aging. I don't have a problem with aging, actually. It's pretty much a part of life, but what I do have a problem of is the disrespect that I've been hearing on especially late night TV, the jokes that are being made to almost really defile the aging process. And it's a disrespect that I'm catching that doesn't seem to be stopped. It seems to be getting worse and worse, where people are making fun of the natural aging process. And it's a disrespect and a defilement of something that really needs to be corrected.
Thanks, Rich.
I think that you're right, Rich. I think that really is true, and it's surprising that as there are more older people in society, instead of us thinking more about how to value being old and in the hope, too, that we will all live long lives, we've actually, I think, become less respectful of the old. And you hear talk about the tsunami of aging, or we have writers such as Martin Amis saying we're soon going to be living in a society of demented older people, and the fears are so very strong, it seems to me, when in fact most of us, most of our lives, are going to be quite capable of interacting well with others and of giving to others, whatever our age. And so it is extremely unfortunate, it seems to me, this contempt which one often can hear towards the elderly.
Thanks for that call, Rich. We'll talk next to Pepper in Shawano. Hi, Pepper.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What's your question or comment?
My comment is I am 56 years old, and I am happier than I have ever been before. I'm not scared to give my opinions on things. I used to be quite shy, and I didn't think anyone was really interested in my opinion. But now I give it. And I don't know. I'm just very, very happy, and I think growing old is great.
Thanks, Pepper. Would you say that that's a common sentiment, Lynn, that with age comes confidence?
I think it's true for some people. It's perhaps true for many people. We can become less anxious about our status in the world, actually, and more accepting of things as they are. The problem is that some people are going to face a whole lot of challenges which they need support from those around them. And And I think it's important for us older people as well to be speaking out, as we've just heard, and to be saying, well, it's fine to be old, and it's fine also, whatever our needs are, to assert them and to say how we feel about the world. And I think it is the case that that a lot of older people do speak out more than young people, you know, but that we are slightly less anxious about other people's opinion of us. I think that is true.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our last minute here, what can we start doing right now to better embrace the inevitability of growing old?
Well, I think thinking in terms of more intergenerational contact, to not be pigeonholed in whatever age we're supposed to be, but to realize that young people will grow old, that old people have been young, and therefore we really do have things to say to each other. It's different to be young today than it was when I was young in the 1950s, in that post-war period. But it's interesting to hear what those differences are. And we have a lot to say to each other and a lot to give each other, it seems to me, if we're prepared to listen.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
That's Lynn Siegel, Anniversary Professor of Psychology and Gender Studies at Birkbeck College in London. She's the author of Out of Time, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging.
Coming up next, we'll be taking a look back almost 46 years to the day when Otis Redding lost his life in Madison.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. 46 years ago, Otis Redding lost his life in Madison, and few events loom as large in city lore. Writer Dean Robbins shares how Redding touched his life.
Otis Redding has a connection to Wisconsin, but it's a sad one. In 1967, the 26-year-old rhythm and blues singer died in Madison's Lake Monona. His plane crashed en route to a concert here. Madison has not taken this piece of music history lightly. The city built a monument to Redding by the lake, and local media retell the story of his crash every year on December 10th. But I have a happier story to tell about Otis Redding. It's a story about his music touching a child 3 decades after his death. The child is my son. Right after his birth, I wanted to make sure he had a feeling for music. None of my child-rearing books covered this topic, so I had to improvise. The solution I hit on was Otis Redding. There is nothing more soulful.
You know she's waiting. Yes.
I decided to play Redding's irresistible songs for my newborn every day for the first year of his life. If that didn't hardwire music into his brain, nothing would. I began a steady diet of hits, like Respect and Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. The song he responded to most, for some reason, was the little-known Loving by the Pound. He giggled and wriggled in my arms as I danced him around the room. Can an early dose of Otis Redding really teach a child to love music? All I can say is, my homemade experiment worked. Even in elementary school, my son responded to a wide range of musical styles. He picked up the guitar, too. I give all credit to Otis. When my son got old enough, I faced a difficult task. I had to tell him the story of Redding's life, complete with its tragic end in our hometown. Otis, I explained, was a prodigy from Georgia who recorded his first single with the Stax label at age 21. He moved audiences around the world with his raw, emotional performances. Otis sang about love more powerfully than any American singer of his era. Indeed, he made his most lasting impression during 1967's Summer of Love at the Monterey Music Festival. A half year later, he decided to go ahead with his flight to Madison, despite dangerous rain and fog. He didn't want to let down his local fans by canceling the show. And that, unfortunately, is the end of the Otis Redding story. But I don't want my son to obsess about what happened on December 10th, 1967. When he thinks about Otis Redding, I want him to think about love, Loving by the Pound.
I've got dreams to remember.
Dean Robbins is the editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative weekly.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now is Craig Werner. He's a professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. He's here to talk about the musical influence of Otis Redding. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be talking.
Well, in terms of Otis Redding's career, where was he at this point in 1967? How popular was he?
Otis had made a breakthrough in about the 6 months prior to his death. Weirdly enough, he never had a top 20 single during his lifetime, but his message had begun to spread rapidly, both through his appearance at Monterey, which was legendary, and the fact that he had written Aretha Franklin's anthem, Respect. And he was on the cusp, I think, of absolute superstardom.
And he was on that cusp. What are the elements, you know, for people who may not be as familiar with his music as others, what were the elements that brought him to that cusp and really started sort of expanding his influence beyond just the traditional, you know, what they used to call the Chitlin' Circuit?
Yeah, there were two things that Otis did. Number one is he brought a really deep Southern gospel singing style into soul music. And when I say soul music, I really mean the soul music that was crossing over to a white audience at the time, which had been prepared by Motown and Sam Cooke. And Otis really kept it in church. And the singing style, the grit, the soul, the emotional depth and complexity was beginning to speak to white audiences. And then secondly, because he was at Monterey with Jimi Hendrix, with The Who, with many of the biggest stars of rock and roll, the spotlight was on him. And he responded to rock, not just in his performing, but also in his songwriting. Dock of the Bay was in part a response to what the Beatles were doing with Sgt. Pepper.
And they responded, I mean, I want to return to that Monterey thing for a second here, because that was such a big game changer. He responded to the audience, and the audience responded to him, and that, you know, as we sit here 46 years down the road, that doesn't sound like that big a deal, but that was a game changer.
It really was. I mean, there's no way to say it that doesn't sound like a cliche, but it was the summer of love, and he just radiated that energy to the audience, and the audience radiated it back to him. There's a great spoken introduction to Try a Little Tenderness that he performed there. That just, he says, this is the love crowd, right? And he gets this roar of response from them. And that call and response is what the black church was all about, and it felt absolutely natural.
I was reading about his life and how he had plenty of gigs lined up for 1968 that I can imagine hundreds, if not thousands, of people were looking forward to being there to see him live. And then, of course, he died in that untimely plane crash. What do you think would have happened if Otis hadn't died in that accident and he was able to continue on with his career?
It's obviously speculating, but I think that Otis Redding, like Sam Cooke before him, had the capability and the vision to affect a kind of racial reconciliation, that his bringing black and white audiences together was something that was very, very unusual at the time. Stevie Wonder would do it a little bit later, but I think that Otis really was at a position where, at a time that black power was rising, there were riots in the cities, that racial tension was a part of the everyday news, he was bringing people together, and I think that he had the potential to spread that even more broadly.
And of course, we know a lot about Otis Redding as a musician, as a lot of historians go back and try to celebrate his career. But what do we know about him as a person?
Well, as a person, Otis Redding just seemed to be beloved. I mean, the love that was in his songs really seems to have been a part of the way people responded to him everywhere. Everyone liked him. That's what soul music is about. It's sincere, it's authentic, it's real, and he was all of those things.
So we should talk about the accident and the plane crash, because that is such a big part of Madison, of the city of Madison. It was early 1967, or late 1967, I guess, December. And Otis Redding had his own plane, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And the band was traveling on it. They were in some bad weather, and they crashed. They didn't make it.
Yeah, and there's never really been any clear notion of what happened with that. There are always rumors, but to the best of my knowledge, just the plane went down. You know, I live right across from the lake, and, you know, I see it every morning. And bad weather, bad luck, maybe a bad decision to travel in it. The thing that always strikes me as most saddest about it is that Otis, after Madison, was going to go back into the studio and finish Dock of the Bay. The whistling verse, which is just amazing and wonderful, was simply there as a placeholder. He was planning on writing another verse and taking that out. And Otis almost certainly never heard the completed record.
And he recorded that, what, just like 3 or 4 days before he died?
Yeah, right before he died. He was in the studio and he was going back in.
And so the aftermath of his death, it meant bad news for a whole bunch of folks, but it also meant some bad news for Stax Records, for the label that he was associated with.
Yeah, because Stax Records had a distribution agreement with Atlantic Records out of New York, and it was up for renegotiation at that point. And from the perspective of Atlantic Records, Otis Redding was the whole show at Stax at that point. I think that wasn't a very good judgment on their part. But after Otis's death, those negotiations fell apart, and Stax really went into a dive. It was to recover a few years later, but it was devastating for Stax, and the loss of the Barquets, the musicians who were with him. Great, great soul band.
Can you think of any examples today that we can listen for and still hear Otis Redding's influence in music?
Yeah, the singer that I would go to on that is a guy named Charles Bradley. And Bradley is recording with the Daptone label, which does a lot of kind of really funky soul music that sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. And Charles Bradley particularly sounds, to my ears, like Otis Redding's spirit and voice has been channeled into the contemporary world. R&B generally, soul music generally, is much more highly produced, but Otis, with the great backing musicians that he had at Stax, really lets the voice carry it, and I do think there's some of that going on today.
Yeah, I wanted to tie in on that. You mentioned Daptone and some of the recordings that are going on there, and right now there seems to be kind of a resurgence of that soul sound. I mean, if Otis were alive now, do you think he'd kind of feel at home to a certain extent in some of these studios?
Well, I think if Otis was alive now, he'd be doing something amazingly creative and different, but sure, he could go into the Daptone studio and record his great songs without blinking, no question.
In our last minute here, why don't you give us a recommendation for maybe one of his lesser known songs and why you think it's worth checking out?
Hard to Handle is the one I would go to. Otis was both a great singer and a good songwriter. He didn't write a lot of songs, but the ones he did were amazing, and Hard to Handle is one. And then there's one called Ton of Joy, which he didn't write, but it's just, to my mind, one of the most gorgeous Southern soul songs you'll ever hear. Wonderful guitar introduction by Steve Cropper, who seemed to be absolutely in sync with Otis all the time. Steve Cropper, great Memphis guitarist.
Well, thanks for those recommendations. Craig Werner, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Craig Werner, professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, talking about the life and legacy of Otis Redding.
Up next on Central Time, we'll talk about how Congress got to the level of inactivity we're seeing today and how gridlock developed over the years. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All you gotta do is try.